In most of the mainstream IT media recently, there has been a lot of coverage of a technology called Form, or a technology by a company called Form, at least. And so this is whereby this is failing miserably, isn't it?
Yes.
Right.
Abuse from the interviewing, Adam.
Normally, somebody actually works out what they're going to say before we interrupt the segment, but sadly, on this occasion.
But this doesn't happen with Radio 4, does it? Episode 18 of Season 5.
It's our 101st show.
Yes, welcome to Lug Radio, and I'm Jonah Bacon.
I'm Stuart Langridge.
I'm Adam Sweet.
I'm Chris Proctor.
What would you disgusting individuals like to talk about on the show?
Well, I think we're going to talk about the restricted format wizard.
Leapt in there a bit quick.
Thank you, disgusting individual number one. We speak to Becky Hogg of the Open Rights Group about Form.
To celebrate our 101st show, we're going to talk about what we'd phone to Room 101.
And, of course, we're going to talk about our experiences with different mail clients. Sorry, I had a moment of... I'm going to refer to it as inspiration. Just then. We're going to talk about the mail clients that we said we'd... I have no idea what I'm talking about again. I'll try it once more.
Please
and
do.
I just play two fingers.
Please do.
I'm on drugs all of a second.
Yes. You feel free to say it at any time at your leisure.
And in the last episode, I challenged us all to try different mail clients, and we are going to come back with the results. So, should we get on with the show?
Maybe we should.
All right.
It's episode 101.
It is.
Mm. And in room 101, you always find the worst things in the world.
Yes, yes, yes you do.
So, Adam, what have you found in room 101?
Thank you for that, Jono. Chris.
It's always a pleasure.
Into room 101, I would like to casually insert the iPod. It does my fucking head in.
What's wrong with the iPod?
Right. It's a wonderful device. It looked great. It's really cool, and it works really nicely.
And you don't have one.
All bad points so far.
And it's the market leader in its field, and it's probably the leader of the portable... digital audio revolution. Yep. But it pisses me off because it doesn't support OGG, and its partner website is DRM encumbered.
Right, so its partner website, which you're referring to as iTunes, is not an iPod.
Nope.
Right?
So it's not an iPod.
It's not, no.
No, but it's part of the iPod ecosystem, isn't it?
In the same way that music is part of the iPod ecosystem.
If you put the iPod into Room 101, then iTunes goes away, because as far as I'm aware, iTunes won't talk to anything else.
True. Yep.
Yeah, but you can use iTunes without an iPod.
No, you can.
Can
you? You can. You can download music and listen to it on your computer. Yeah, as long as your computer is a Windows computer or a Mac computer.
Right. Okay.
Interesting, because up until the point where you said about DRM and whatever it was, I wasn't listening. But to be honest,
well, to be honest, neither was I. Really,
you actually were starting to sound like a really good Apple marketing guy. Because you really, I want to buy a third iPod.
It just frustrates me. And he's moving on from the newest, isn't he?
Yeah, it just frustrates.
Former loyalty.
Ooh, it just frustrates me because it is a fantastic device, and it's the market leader in its field, and it does all the things that I don't like.
It's you basically don't like it because it doesn't run OGG. It doesn't support OGG. Right.
And it doesn't support
Freedom. So why aren't you putting every other media player that doesn't support OGG into the...
Because iPod is the market leader.
Right, okay.
And it's effectively the cutting edge of the digital portable audio market.
Right, okay.
Fair enough.
It's not just the market leader in terms of the number that's been sold. It's the market leader in terms of defining what this kind of device ought to look like.
Yeah,
it's a thought leader.
Yes, yeah. And it is the most desirable of all portable audio players. And
it's to be fair though. I mean, admittedly, it doesn't play OGG. That's a bad thing. We all support OGG, absolutely. It's a fucking nice device, though.
It is a fantastic device. And
they could be so much more, though, couldn't they?
Yeah, and it just frustrates me because aside from all that, it just doesn't do the two things I care
most
about.
It's kind of surprising as well that Apple don't support OGG, because you'd imagine that OGG is going to be a marginal part of the market. The kind of people who are going to use OGG or care about OGG are mostly going to only be people like us.
And
and it's like most people are going to get their AAC encoded DRM nonsense from. I bollocks, and
I'm so glad you're making my point for me, because I only had this bit to say about the iPod, and I was just going to go back to sleep.
Apple won't support OGG because they're worried about submarine patents.
Really?
Really?
Yeah, that's why they won't support OGG Theora. That's why they refused to put Theo with the video tag in HTML. They said, we're not going to do Theo.
But wasn't Theo actually donated?
But they've got, well, they might be submarine patents, so we can't do it. But they're happy to take something which they can license from the creator, which by definition is not going to be open source.
License.
Because it's been licensed.
From the creator.
From the creator. You know, but they're not going to, they basically refuse to touch Og Theor, and I assume that they feel exactly the same way about Vorbis.
I believe the technical description of that kind of perspective is a crock of shit.
Yes, absolutely.
And moving on then.
Flying in from the fucking sky. Fuck you, Apple.
So, Mr. Langridge, would you like to gently nuzzle into bosom of 101?
Gently nuzzle into room 101 is technical books.
As the author of two technical books.
As the author of two technical books, you know.
What would you... I'll
be honest with you. It was interesting writing them. I mean, I'm not sitting pretty on my huge pile of cash or anything.
But then again, you spend it all on snow.
But then again, nobody is in the technical book industry. It works for Stephen King, doesn't work. But the point is not about the money. It's about the books are outdated technology. You know, I mean, of the technical books that you own, everybody in this room, everybody listening to it, I bet half of them are out of date now.
Looking at my bookshelf.
I mean, looking at John O's bookshelf, 100% of those books are out of date.
That's not entirely true. No, some of them are practical C programming.
Exciting book about PHP 1.
It amuses me that John has got, after all the slagging he gives it, he's got a book on Emacs and a book on Perl.
Well, yeah, I know. But the point is that books go out of date really quickly. How often do you find yourself actually reaching for a book to find something the internet?
I happen to think that I was starting to agree with you more and more before we'd had this conversation. These days, it's dead easy just to find a simple how to. The amount of how-tos on the web these days for server stuff or Linux stuff in general is incredible. And it's just a quick recipe to get what you want, in a sense. But if you need a reference...
If you need to actually
something.
Understand it in detail.
I must confess, because I do what I do web stuff, it's such a fast-moving field that you publish a book today and it's completely out of date tomorrow. Yeah. I mean, it may well be different if it's a book about the bash shell.
Yeah.
Or Emacs.
Well, Unix Power Tools book is still valid after 10 years. Or
how valid? I mean, it'll tell you about things like find and how to do it. But these days, wouldn't you just use Beagle to search for something? Which isn't even mentioned in there.
Don't have that on servers commonly.
Well, that's the point. I'm quite prepared to admit that outdated book technology works well for documenting outdated computer technology.
I think there's a difference between, there's some stuff, as you say, the kind of fast-moving stuff that kind of changes every week, which is web technology like what you use. And there's other stuff that is classic, that will always be there, you know, like the underpinnings of, as you say, Bash. Bash has been the same for kind of 10 years.
Things and
will
like
be
the protocols as well.
Yeah, protocols. I mean, some stuff stays the same.
For protocols, would you not just read the RFCs, which are on the internet? I'm not suggesting that documentation should go away. This is paper books.
But the thing is, RFCs are unreadable.
I think you're getting away from the purpose of many books, though. I mean, the purpose of a book is invariably, so, you know, to teach you how to do something, you know. So you'll buy, you know, a great example is PHP MySQL books. There's hundreds of them, right? And you buy them and it teaches you how to program using those technologies. And it goes through in a tutorial format. Now, yes, it might be out of date, but the major benefit to me is that, like Adam says, there's tons of how-tos and things like that, but they're relatively small and contained, whereas when you get a book, it's a more thorough.
You've got
thorough
to invest
thing.
Yourself yeah. in doing something yeah. for...
I don't agree. I mean, take your PHP and MySQL example, right? If you bought a book, unless you buy a PHP and MySQL book within 6 months of it being published, and then you use it within 6 months of buying it, the advice it gives you will be wrong.
That's
not just out of date; it will be
the
wrong way.
That's true about some of the information in there, but 90% of what goes into a book, you know, how to do SQL is the same and has been the same.
It doesn't change as much as you think. I mean, admittedly, for a new user, that will be a risk because you don't know what has changed, what hasn't changed. But yes, books are outdated; they get outdated quicker. However, some people like... I mean, the other major benefit of a book is that you can read it without having a computer in front of you.
Yeah.
You know, people read it sat in the bog, or people read it on the bus, or people read it, you know, in their lunch break and something like that, you know, where you can't do that.
I think, as we've already stated, right, the how-tos solve the problem where you need to do something quickly and you just need a quick kind of soundbite that tells you how to do what you want to do. But I think, as we've discussed on why servers aren't boring, or maybe perhaps why they are, server technology tends to move a lot more slowly. And, for example, today... I had to do some stuff in PostFix, and I haven't touched PostFix in 4 years, and there I have my four-year-old PostFix book, and it was perfectly relevant.
I think
and
some books, like the Hacks style of books, probably do that quite quickly, because they are exactly what's on the internet. They're kind of the quick recipes. Yeah. People who write
the most imperfect thing. Just wrapping up, the reason why I don't use books is because I just find it an imperfect medium for when I want to learn how to do something. Because, for example, I can't cut and paste from a book,
and you can't search,
you can search a book. You can very look very slow.
I mean, freely, I'm using books less and less and less. It's only when I actually have to invest myself
when you want to learn something,
understand something completely.
I honestly find myself with a big pile of books that I basically don't read anymore.
Same here. Mm-hmm. Looking at my bookshelf,
I'd happily read those books electronically.
I did have 15 boxes of computer books at one point.
Jeez.
Yeah, I
start programming with the electron.
I was going to say I stole them all, but I didn't actually steal them. My boss at the bookshop I worked at let us take these books. Like all the paperbacks and the hardbacks were like £1 and £2.
Mr. Baker, what would you like to insert into the slippery nipple of
101? I'd like to say complainers.
Not the community.
No, not the community. Complainers.
So hang
you want
on,
to complain it... about people who complain?
I just don't like... I'm going to complain about people who complain. It's one thing that really, really... I know it's very generic, but it really agitates me. People who just fucking whinge constantly. And, you know, to me, it's like, if you've got a problem with something, you've got an issue with something, fine. But just have a solution. You know, try and at least propose a solution to the problem. And it's interesting because my boss, Matt Zimmerman, he'll often apologise, like when he says, oh, yeah, this isn't very good. And if he can't, he'll apologise if he can't provide a solution. He'll say, I feel really bad because, you know, I'm complaining, but I don't actually have a proposed solution. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody should take that approach. And there's so many complainers and whingers on the internet and in our community, who will complain about the smallest things. And
you're so asking for a kick in here.
Of course I am.
On the forums, we're going to be lynched for this.
We've had this discussion before, I'm sure, ages ago. Don't you think that being as... the four of us in this room, and I guess most of the people listening to the show, as we spend a good proportion of our waking lives staring at a computer with its binary success or failure, one or zero, black or white way of existence, right? Don't you think the real world is just generally really fucking irritating by comparison? Because there's all these grey areas that just people with their personality defects can't handle.
I don't know, I mean, it doesn't surprise me that, it doesn't surprise me for a second that the kind of stereotypical demographic of the socially inept geek, when you put all of those people into a very, very large community, that you will get bickering.
A lot of fucking whinging.
But I don't know. This applies is equal to people in the normal world as well. You know, like when something happens and people go out complaining and whinging and at the smallest of things. I mean, GTA 4 is a great example. GTA 4 has been released. Not caused any... certainly not in my life, apart from being chased by the police for eating a pasty while I was driving the other day.
Yes.
it's not caused any significant...
You get the special bum search.
The point is not that you were chased by the police. The point is that you roared away from them and escaped, having bought GTA 4 the previous day.
I was a fugitive from the law.
Did you get 4 stars in the window of your car?
But no, I don't know. I just...
It wasn't in his car. He'd just stolen a car.
Clubbed a man to death.
If the purpose of Room 101 is to banish things from the world that shouldn't be there, I think the world would be a better place, and the open source community would be a better place if people stopped complaining and whinging without proposing a solution to the problem. My proposed solution to the problem is that these people fuck off.
Fair enough.
Christopher.
Chris off.
Enlighten us.
The thing that really needs to be thrust forcefully into Room 101.
Is this going to be a driver or something?
Desktop.
Email.
Email.
The whole fucking thing.
Thank you very much for putting
email
me out
clients,
of a job.
Email clients, email servers, people who send me emails, this people who expect emails back. They all deserve.
Email?
This is because you use K-mail.
Yeah. You do realise that life outside of K-mail is really bright and bubbly.
No, it isn't.
There's no spam.
You propose to communicate with people how? On Twitter?
I don't care. Telepathically does me.
No.
I suppose phones help.
I'm assuming, Jono, when you said everyone needs to propose a solution, it's got to be an actual possible solution.
Yeah.
No, seriously. You'd have to throw out the whole email infrastructure, redesign it with something that actually fucking works.
Like
something that works. Redesign
like
it. Yeah, Chrismail would do. That's the word.
So you're not talking about
something
getting rid of
security.
So you're not talking about getting rid of email. The concept. It's email. The implementation. You want to get rid of SMTP.
SMTP, definitely.
So you're complaining about You're not complaining at the fact that everybody uses email and you get deluged with it.
Well, there's an element of that. Yeah, I don't.
You're
going to
get that with any medium.
Yeah.
People
will ask me
to do work for anything. This is a fair point.
If you actually invent your magic telepathy thing, then what happens is you have people shouting in your fucking head all the time. How is that better? Oh, no, wait, it isn't better.
He's got that already. I have to point out that if what you'd like to get rid of actually happens, I'd be out of a job. And also, I guess, if Exchange might have worked out how to protect itself from the ills of the internet, then so I would be out of a job again.
Exchange, classic example of why email should be shut.
Until 6 months ago, somehow some people banished burgers, you'd be out of a job as well.
Amusing. And don't be so horrible to Ack.
Oh!
After a proper job.
So, yeah, right, so everybody just realised how fat I actually am today because I'm wearing a ill-fitting t-shirt.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Ill-fitting t-shirt. But
I don't want to disappoint you. I was speaking to someone who's experienced with this matter. You're not fat because you're wearing the wrong t-shirt. You're fat because you eat too many buns.
Thank you. So, right, so are we basically all agreeing there then? SMTP and email. The email.
I don't believe anybody was agreeing.
Well, the fact that we moved on so swiftly onto a different topic obviously means you agree.
Anyone's disagreeing with the fact that SMTP has been irrevocably broken, but no one can think of a better way.
Not even any good email clients. They're all just rubbish.
There were loads of good email clients.
They're all rubbish in their own way. That's all of this.
Do you often sit there thinking, you know what? I think SMTP is irretrievably broken.
I was thinking it only this morning.
Yeah, yeah. I often
wonder. When you get deluged by spam, you don't get worried about that at all.
I often complain about the way that IMAP is not being implemented properly.
Spam, right?
Shut the fuck up, you.
The problem with spam can't be fixed with technology.
Yes, it can.
No, it can't.
It can be fixed with Viagra.
If the government gave everyone free Viagra, then there'd be no need for spam.
Available from Adam Sweet.
Actually, no.
A lot of the problems with spam could be solved by technology. Could be solved by closing open relays. Could be solved by doing various tar pitting kind of things.
The problem here is that people are too stupid.
My magnificent chinoid.
Did you say carpeting?
No.
Why would he have said that?
He said something...
Tar pitting.
What the hell is tar pitting?
When basically an email's... client connects and it looks like it might be spam, so you slow everything down to a snail's pace, so it takes forever to send the email. So
the point being that if you, John, are sending an email and instead of having to wait 2 seconds, you have to wait 15 seconds, it doesn't bother you that much. If you're trying to send 6 million emails, then if each one takes 10 times as long,
good idea.
You disconnect and go somewhere else.
So it's a technical solution to the
spam. It's not a technical
problem.
Solution, it's a bodge, is what it is.
But it works.
The way of solving spam is to make it uneconomic to send it.
Which is exactly what that does.
Not really.
But if you knew who it was, then you'd be able to trace where the email came from, where the spam came from. That's the other way.
But then you have to solve the identity problem.
I think we're digressing.
We're trying to solve
the spam problem as opposed to trying to get this way wrong.
Part of the same thing.
I'd like to put Chris's stupid ideas into room 101.
All server technology into room 101.
Oh, it's because you pair, since when they're looking at the fucking minutae of X, care.
The what? Yeah.
The
minutae of X.
Do I get the impression that's a word you've only ever seen written?
Yeah. Well, it looks like a care, really.
Minutiae.
Yeah. Written down on the packaging that his underpants come in.
So that was room 101 in episode 101.
Oh, yeah.
There's been a lot of coverage in the mainstream IT media recently over a company called Form. And on the phone right now, we've got Becky Hogg, who's here to tell us about Form.
Hello, Becky.
Hi.
Incidentally, Becky, have you seen the Lug Radio video clip that somebody made with your representation?
The Lug Radio Live US?
I don't think... It wasn't...
Yeah, it was a trailer.
All right.
Really? Yeah, I did. I'm kind of... It works up to a crescendo, and then I shout something about software patents. So I was actually that.
Cool. I was actually referring to the competition entry. I think you were represented as a puppet of some kind, but as we all were.
Really?
Anyway, sorry to digress.
Hang on, what?
You've got to explain it to her now.
Right, oh, okay.
A puppet, did you say?
There was a Lug Radio competition entry whereby somebody cut together some clips of some Lug Radio audio and represented us all as puppets, and you were in it.
Oh, well, that's very exciting.
And in the meantime, we've got you on the phone to tell us about Form. So could you tell us briefly what Form is?
Well, Form is a company, and they have developed a system called WebWise. And they claim to be in partnership with various ISPs, including Virgin, TalkTalk, and BT. And what they intend to do is they intend to Well, they basically serve targeted adverts based on what you browse online. So right now, when you're on a website and there are ads there, they might be Google ads, they might be other sorts of ads, they're based on the content of the web page that you're viewing now.
Yep.
So, you know, if you're reading something about... I mean, I used to work at a news organisation, and whenever we did stuff about Russia... You know, Google ads for Russian brides would come up in the
nice. Did you buy any?
But they're generally based on the content of the web page you're viewing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what Forms WebWise system proposes to do is to serve you ads based on what you've viewed before.
Right.
So, if you've been online checking out, I don't know, rentals in your area, like home rentals, or if you've been looking at to buy cars or to book a holiday, then the next time you go to the New York Times or I don't know if the New York Times are a partner website, but to one of the websites that's using the Form WebWise system, like a current affairs site or whatever, you might see car adverts there if you've been browsing for cars, or sports adverts there if you've been checking out the football results before. That's basically what their system purports to do from the outside. Now, sort of from the inside, and how that works is that they ship a load of equipment into the ISPs that they partner with, and like I mentioned, that's BT, Virgin, and Carphone Warehouse, or TalkTalk, I think their broadband's called. And they analyze the stuff that you're looking at online based on the traffic that's running by your ISP. They do a lot of anonymization, so that they'll look at each page you're looking at in turn, and they'll say, right, what are the top 10 words on that page? Maybe it's Ford or Vauxhall or whatever, and then they'll look at cars, or maybe it's Croatia or Dubrovnik, and then they'll think maybe she's looking at holidays, and they'll then put you into a channel. They won't write any of the data about what you've been looking at to disk, but they'll put you in a channel, like this person obviously likes gardening, or this person obviously likes holidays or whatever, and then next time an ad, next time you're on a page which asks for a Form WebWise ad, they'll serve you an ad based on the channels that you're in. Does that make any sense?
Gotcha.
Does that make sense?
That's a good way of describing it, I think. Now, I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second, Becky. I can understand how this has got the hackles up of people who are interested in digital rights and protection of privacy and that kind of thing. But do you think that the general everyday punter who drinks a Starbucks and reads The Sun...
Isn't that you?
That might be me. I don't read The Sun. I like Starbucks, admittedly. I read The Guardian. Do you think that everyday people are actually going to care about this, whether this is a privacy issue or have a problem with this? Because it sounds like to a lot of people they might think, well, hang on a second, yeah, I don't really actually care if someone's sniffing my data and displaying some ads to me.
Well, I mean, I think I see the point you're trying to make, and people do get angry about, say, junk mail coming through their letterbox, but. Now, over the years, we've sort of learned to live with it, haven't we?
I mean,
we're marketed to, we're advertised to all the time, and I think people are becoming more and more savvy about how stuff like, reward card systems at supermarkets try, and not just at supermarkets, but you can get them everywhere now, can't you? How advertisers try really hard to find out as much about us as possible so they can serve relevant adverts. And, to a certain extent, the general public may feel like they've got used to that already, and they might just take this next stuff in their stride.
Right.
However, I think the moment that people are going to care about it is that when it really impacts on their everyday lives. So, if you can imagine, you're browsing on the internet to buy a gift for your loved one.
Yeah.
And then the next time they're on the internet, they notice that maybe it's flowers, or maybe it's a fast car, or maybe you're booking a hotel room, or that sort of thing. And the next time your loved one comes on the internet, and let's face it, not everyone has their own account on their computers and stuff. Then they might, you might have the surprise spoiled because you'll see all these ads being served up for the stuff your lover or whoever is about to buy you. I mean, I'm saying that, and I know it's a pretty weak argument, and privacy is actually a really strange thing.
But it's outlining the point.
People will sell it for 10p off a hamburger. They will sell it to get, reward points and money off vouchers. So it's a really interesting debate from that perspective, because when the Form story broke, You know, a lot of people got very angry very quickly. But, you know, sure, they might be in a minority. But, we fought for a long time for privacy rights. And I think that, in fact, it's up to the informed minority to keep, you know, to keep fighting for those rights.
You can kind of see how certain people may view certain sites and not want certain other people to see that they've viewed certain sites. You can imagine how this is going to backfire for a lot of people.
Just to quell your fears on that point. I don't know if it will quell your fears, but in terms of...
I'd like to clarify, this isn't me I'm talking about.
It's a friend of yours.
It's a friend called Bono.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Well, let's say Bono likes visiting, I don't know, adult content, then he might be a bit shocked next time he's on, you know, what was it, the Guardian website, and some adult adverts start cropping up now. Of course, you know, Form have already thought of this, and what they say is they're not going to have any channels about adult content. They're not going to accept adverts from people who want to serve adverts to people who are interested in adult content,
such as
so
kind
that
of
situation doesn't happen.
Such as kind of BridgetTheMidget.com.
Sorry, say that again.
Such as BridgetTheMidget.com.
Shut up!
I'm not familiar with that site.
Yeah, it's I heard about it from Mac.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, the point is, I think there's a serious point to make here, guys. So, you know, calm down for a second. they said they're not going to do this. And, you know, we can take them on trust on that. However, you know, they're a commercial company.
Gotcha.
And if the system doesn't perform as well, or if their shareholders or whoever, you know, their investors say, no, look, guys, we need to change those rules, then once the system's in place, it's going to be a lot harder for us to do that. To hold them to account for that.
Right, which is a reasonable point, a reasonable thing to be worried about. The question I was going to ask before I got slightly sidetracked by the concept of people getting busted for looking at porn on the internet was, is the primary objection that you've got against this the fact that it's... the fact that a system like this can go into place, is the fact that we're in a society now where this kind of thing's acceptable to happen, a company can make this kind of system happen, or are you primarily thinking of the individual privacy issues, or is it both?
Okay, I tell you, this has been a really interesting one from the start, because if you take I'd advise every one of your listeners to go take a look at the analysis that Richard Clayton from the Foundation for Information Policy Research has done on Form, and to also look at the privacy impact assessment, the initial one that's been produced by a company called 8020 Thinking Limited, because some of the stuff that they're proposing to do about anonymizing people's data, you know, before they put them into these channels and the like, is actually fairly progressive. You know, to the extent that you could almost call this technology privacy enhancing, but, and it's a big but, because of the level of the stack they're operating on, because they're operating at the network level, they're actually in violation of the laws that govern the interception of communications in this country. That's the laws that govern, you know, whether the police or indeed your local council can intercept communications what circumstances they can do that, and whose consent they need before they can do that. And that law is called the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act.
It is.
Digital rights activists will have come across that before, during the kind of crypto wars of the 1990s. That was a big focus, because what it does about cryptographic keys. But it also regulates, Section 1 regulates, the interception of communications. So there's been a great piece of legal analysis done by the Foundation for Information Policy Research, done by their general counsel, Nicholas Bohm, which shows pretty much that this technology is going to be in violation of that act. And I think it's at the core of that which has kept the Open Rights Group involved in this issue, because it turns out that, you know, the people who oversee the regulation, overseeing and, enforcing the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act is actually really hard. You know, it should be a matter of the police if someone's intercepting communications illegally. And yet we have one guy described in Nicholas Bohm's analysis who tried to make a complaint with his local police and was told that it was a matter for the Home Office. And, you know, at the end of the day, it can only be decided in the courts. I think it's indicative, if a technology is breaking this very, very... This is the stuff that regulates how the government can intercept communications with suspected terrorists. It's the stuff that says, you know, if you're a family of a kidnap victim, whether the communications between you and the kidnappers can be intercepted. And in fact, the law says that you need both the kidnapper's permission and the kidnapper's family's permission. You know, and yet, you know, there is a commercial technology which potentially breaks this law. I think because it's breaking the law at that fundamental level, it kind of flags up that this stuff just ain't right. It really isn't. I mean, the stuff that we're doing with our lives online, and it's not just about adult content, it's about forums that you might be participating in to, you know, get over a medical disease, or communications you might be having with people involved in really sensitive information like trade union, religion, sexuality, the kind of stuff that the Data Protection Act takes really, really seriously. You know, the internet and online communications are playing a big part here. And your relationship with your ISP needs to be straight down the line. You need to have trust in them, almost in the way I'd say that you need to have trust in your doctor.
Yes.
You know, because it's that private, it's that personal. And if they start, you know, listening in on what you're doing just so they can target better ads at you, I think we really need to ask questions.
I mean, one of the things that, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but the difference between this and loyalty cards, say, is that loyalty cards opt in, and this is opt out. I can choose to go and get a loyalty card if I think, you know, I'm prepared to give up my privacy to Sainsbury's or whoever in exchange for money off vouchers, that's cool. But as I understand this, my ISP decides to put form in, and I've got to then go and say, I don't really want form.
Which means you have to know in the first
place. Do I understand that correctly? Or
I'm not sure you do. See, the information, you've definitely got the right point. And, you know, the Open Rights Group doesn't normally get involved where it's private companies potentially infringing rights, because, you know, we've taken a view the government are up to enough stuff that we need to keep our eye on, and people can always go and shop elsewhere if rights are being infringed, you know, at the private level. But because it's the major ISPs, you know, they're covering a vast percentage of the country, it's
exactly
going to be increasingly difficult for people to get to get internet service provision, you know, from the smaller ISPs. Now, the Information Commissioner, who regulates the Data Protection Act, and he sort of enforces that, although rather weakly because he's been given very little resources and he's been posted miles away from London, has come out and said if these systems are going to be compliant with the Data Protection Act, they must be opt-in and not opt-out. It must be like your loyalty card. You must be able to say, yes, I want to do this. Now, what we're going to push for, and what I believe the Information Commissioner would also push for, is informed consent. We're not talking about, we just sent an email to the account you never used telling you we've updated our terms and conditions. We're talking about a proper tick box, yes, I want this to happen. So, I think you're going to have informed consent. Now, the RIPA violation thing is interesting because, you know, you can intercept communications with consent from the parties who are communicating.
Yeah,
but, of course, when you're online, that's you and some random website. And there's very little practical way that your ISP or form or whoever is going to be able to get consent from every site on the web that they can intercept the communications between you and them.
Sure. We're going to wrap up in a moment, but while we've still got you on the line, there's a few things I wanted to say about this before kind of we start to wrap it up. I mean, in the UK, I think there's about six ISPs who have at least signed up, whether they've deployed or not. Some have, some haven't. Certainly BT trialled twice, once in 2006 and 2007, and it's an opt-out policy for BT.
Check the research.
I researched. Sorry, they claimed, at first they claimed it was just for fun. And now we can't get enough. TalkTalk, also known as the Carphone Warehouse, or again, I think they're an opt-in. Tiscali, Sky and Orange in the UK have signed up and are investigating but haven't actually deployed it yet. If your ISP is one of the ISPs that are trialling form or using it, there's a Firefox plugin called Defamation, Dephormation, defamation.org.uk. I think that might be about it. Sorry, I'm not talking to the microphone. So, and also, I looked into this as well. About 10% of American traffic is filtered by similar organisations. I looked into Australia as well. There doesn't appear to be any deployment yet over there, but I just thought our listeners might be interested. Sorry, pass on the phone.
That's
really cool.
Are there digital rights organisations in other countries who are getting similar problems? I mean, do you stay in touch with people like that?
We do stay in touch with people like that, and we've spoken briefly with the Electronic Frontier Foundation on you know, we work with digital rights organisations across Europe and America on some issues. We haven't had much contact with other digital rights organisations, and in fact, the news that 10% of traffic is filtered in this way already in America is news to me, and I'll certainly be looking into that.
Hi, Jackie. Just a quick question. So we've covered a lot of what you're doing about form, but what else is an open rights group? Sort of just quick summary of what else they're involved in at the moment.
All right, so we just observed the London elections, which deployed electronic counting. So all of the votes for London Mayor and the London Assembly were counted by computers, and at the end of the month we'll be filing a report on that. We were again, like last year, accredited as official observers for that. So okay. We're continuing to try and press for, well, we oppose the introduction of electronic voting into elections in the UK, and we're trying to press for more transparent electronic counting and specifically manual audits of counts. So we're doing a bit of that. We have been actually had a really exciting day today because a story about knitting patterns and Doctor Who broke.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if any of you saw that, but we've had all sorts of newspapers in touch. It's just one of those stories.
Could you explain what that is, Becky, for people who
okay,
not
so an enthusiastic knitter and Doctor Who fan posted knitting patterns to recreate characters such as the Adipose and the Ood in knitted form. And the BBC sent an email telling her she didn't have any permission to use the trademark or copyright and told her to take it down. And she took it down. And then she got in touch with us and she said, I don't think this is really fair and I don't feel like I've been treated fairly. And we said, no, we agree and we think this is a fantastic story. So we publicised it. The Times broke the story today and, well, the Times broke the story in the Dead Tree Press today. It's been all over the internet for about a week. And we've got the Mail and the BBC, and it was the most read BBC story. So we've just been fielding journalists we've never heard of talking to us about this. It's really interesting because we've been pushing for ages for an exception for transformative use and derivative works to be implemented in copyright law, which the government actually agreed to do a couple of years ago. So this is a great example of why this should happen. So we've been working quite hard on that. And we're hiring. We're hiring a new campaigner because we're focusing on a couple of sites upcoming in Europe. One is the fight to stop rights holders from being able to tell your ISP to disconnect you from the internet if they suspect you of illicit file sharing. And the other is our campaign against copyright term extension on sound recordings, the Beatles Copyright Term Extension Act. We managed to fight that off in the UK a couple of years ago. When was it? 2006. Now we're taking that fight to Europe. So it's copyright, IP stuff, electronic voting, and then this whole privacy shebang with form. We're fairly busy at the moment, I can tell.
Yeah.
Excellent.
One very, very quick final question. The Doctor Who thing is a great example of this. There must be some days when you get up and you just think to yourself, why the hell do we bother when you hear about these kinds of things happening? You know, the world is going crazy and, you know, in many ways, obviously, it's going to encourage you to fight the power, essentially, and make sure that we're living in a more open and fair society. But what is it, I'm interested to know, what is it that you personally, Becky Hogg, get out of getting up every day and doing this? What is your personal motivation for this?
God, that's a really interesting question.
Money.
I think I'm basically psychologically flawed. That's probably it. I think I can make the world a better place.
Right.
You know, I haven't got that downbeaten feeling, which I think all activists get after a while. They think they spend so long banging their head against a brick wall that they think, oh my God, why should I bother? You know, I could get far better paid doing something else.
Yeah.
But in truth, if you look back at the Open Rights Group's record, you know, we've had some serious successes. We got the Electoral Commission last year to tell, you know, the UK's elections regulator to tell the government, I wouldn't like to take full credit for this. We helped them realise that electronic voting and electronic counting were immature technologies that shouldn't be introduced into UK elections. And in 2006, you know, the government agreed with us the copyright term shouldn't be extended.
Yeah.
On stuff like ID cards, on the whole privacy thing, we're right at the beginning of a long engagement with government and with policymakers to just help them understand how worrying digital network technology really changes the game in terms of privacy, and we're right at the beginning of that.
Right, right.
But I tell you what gets me out of bed in the morning, apart from being an incredible insomniac, is results, and we're seeing results, and that gives me hope that we can see results on a lot of stuff
nice.
In the future.
Excellent.
So, do you know
fantastic.
What I mean? I actually think it's worthwhile, and that's why I do it.
Fantastic. Well, Becky, we always love having you on the show, and obviously at Look Radio Live, which I unfortunately believe you can't make this year, is that
she
right?
She hates
freedom.
I know,
freedom. It's a bummer. I really messed up there. That definitely, Open Rights Group will be sending some really fabulous people along to,
that's
to,
what we
to
like.
See you guys. So, and, sorry I can't make it.
And tell us where our glorious listeners can find out more about the Open Rights Group.
You can find out more at the Open Rights Group at www.openrightsgroup.org. We rely almost completely on individual UK citizens donating £5 a month or whatever they can afford to keep going. So if you like what you've heard and the work we're doing, please consider supporting the Open Rights Group, and you can do that through the website. And Jono, are you supporting the Open Rights Group yet?
I am. I'm supporting it in faith and in support.
One day, Jono, one day we'll get you. The first man to sign the org pledge, one day we'll get you.
Yeah, you will. You will.
Fantastic.
Send some spam.
I live to make you proud, Jono. Proud enough to put your hand in your wallet.
I'm always proud of everything you guys do there.
Sorry, Jono unfortunately only pays for incredibly large TVs.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Yeah, sorry, I could not.
Well, Becky, we always hate having you on Look Radio, and we hope you don't come to Look Radio Live ever again.
Thanks a lot, guys. Thanks for letting me talk. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Take care, Becky.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.
In the last show, we had a segment in which I was asking why people thought Evolution was so shit, as in the mail client, not the concept. And
that joke wasn't any funnier in the last show.
It's not intended as a joke. It's intended as just in case people are like, oh, yeah, Glug Radio talking about their socio-political bullshit again.
I don't want to disappoint you here, but I think the crossover fucking Venn diagram between Glug Radio listeners and Christian fundamentalists is not that big a crossover.
So towards the end of that segment, I said, okay, well, why don't we all mix it up with the mail clients? And I said I'd use Thunderbird, and I asked Chris to use Evolution, and Adam to use Evolution, and Ack to use K-Mail.
Ah, I choose K-Mail.
Your shipment of 1995 technology has arrived. Chris explodes.
Shipment of K-Mail.
How did we get on? So speaking of which, Captain Ginge, how did you get on with K-Mail?
I installed K-Mail, which was entertaining. Well, I thought, okay, I'll get this one mail client. It pulled in 840 gigabytes of KDE dependencies, but, you know, I needed to install them at some point. And I successfully used it to read my Gmail email over IMAP, but I never managed to configure it to actually send mail through SMTP, through Gmail's SMTP server. I followed two or three guides out there on the web about this is how to set up Kmail to work with Gmail. And as I say, I successfully read the mail, but because I couldn't reply, I kept having to get, you know, I'd read the emails and say, right, bin that one, that's an interesting one, go off to my web browser, start up Gmail, find the email again, and then reply
so
to it.
This is weird, because I've never had any trouble setting up SMTP on Kmail.
I'm assuming I was doing... Bear in mind...
This isn't a fault in Kmail,
you're not going to use KMTP or something.
Bear with me, Gmail's SMTP is... it's done over TLS or SSL or something, and you have to use a different port and so on. So I followed a couple of guides, and I couldn't get it to work. I actually made some notes about Kmail when I was using it, and there's a few things which annoyed the hell out of me, and there's a few things that I thought were really nice. One of them, there's when you're using it, when it's checking for mail or whatever, there's a little kind of arrow appears on the status bar at the bottom. If you click the arrow, it turns into a little pop-up window showing you what it's doing.
Yes.
Which I thought that's a bloody nice idea. So you can get that information if you want it. If you don't, it's just a little arrow.
Yeah.
You know, it's really unobtrusive until you care about that information. There are a few things like I told it, go away and check every 1 minute for new emails. But you have to close down Kmail and open it up again before it bothers to pay attention to that.
That's ridiculous.
Which was really annoying. I mean, I'm kind of used to Gnome and Instant Apply.
Surely, you know, that's a bug anyway.
Well, it may be a bug. I mean, the other thing about it is that the thing which said check for email every 1 minute or whatever actually said email checking. It was some ridiculous phrase like email checking interval. Or something. And if that was a Gnome application, that would have said check for my mail every box minutes.
Right. Okay. Email checking interval is that.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not that confusing a statement.
It's not. It's just
unnecessary.
Just little things. Like, I mean, and that's because I don't buy into the KDE way, but people who like KDE absolutely do. I mean, you, Chris, would probably say that some of this email checking interval is actually clearer than a stupid Englishy check my email.
I don't think it's
clearer,
but I don't see that it's no harder.
You know,
Germanized English.
I mean, it reaffirmed my belief that I'm sure Kmail is quite a reasonable client, and I'm sure it integrates very well with the rest of KDE and so on, but it and the philosophy it endows are not for me.
I have to ask a question.
I did use it.
Because all the KDE people are probably exploding at this point. Do you know which version of KML you were using, or was it from KDE 3 or 4?
I'm assuming it's from KDE 3 because I'm still running Ubuntu Gatsy.
Cool.
Because I'm not running Hardy, as far as I'm aware, KDE 4's not in it. It may be a lot better. And again, I'm not saying KML's rubbish or anything. I'm just saying it doesn't work. It doesn't feel the way I like things to feel.
Oh, fair enough. See, I've never had any issues with that. But
yeah. How did you get on with Evolution?
Johnny looks at me. I tried to install it, and it demanded all sorts of horrific dependencies that I wasn't prepared to install in my work machine, such as new versions of GTK. So
I didn't even bother.
Because
you're busy running GTK 1.2. Yeah.
Something. It's,
how dare it require new software?
It's something like that. But
well, no, I mean, I just had a pop at the Kmail people for pulling in loads of KDE dependencies.
Yeah, and that was unnecessary as well. You didn't have anything to do with K installed on your machine. And you complained that it required KDE dependencies.
Yeah. Who rejected the update for kernel?
Winchbag SquarePants.
I mean, to be quite honest with you, Evolution depends on the entirety of the GNOME desktop, as far as I can tell. So
you didn't even bother?
You didn't bother
the summary of this story.
I attempted it and it
failed.
But I did try Thunderbird out briefly. Instead,
I believe that was not per the directions.
Fair enough. Then I won't tell you about it.
Tell us about Thunderbird.
Tell us about Thunderbird.
No, I'm not done now.
All right, then. Adam.
Yeah, spiteful. Ooh, get her.
Attention seeker.
Well, I have to point out that it's only 6 days since we recorded the last show, and I haven't had a chance to try anything.
So you haven't done it either?
So Ack and I, we had a chance. You.
You obviously have less busy social lives
than
what we do.
You don't have to apply for car insurance and deal with your bank not sending you the thing so you can make payments or out of your account and mow a fucking football pitch and things like that.
Although, have you seen Bacon's back garden?
Yes. Well, mine's exactly the same as Bacon's back garden, except 8 times bigger and more overgrown at the top end.
Right. So,
I do plan to. Sorry,
not
maybe
too unlike other parts of Adam Sweet's lifestyle.
I've talked about Kmail. Your shipment of server have failed to install anything. You both lose.
Maybe I do plan to try it, but maybe I'll come back to you under the show if anybody cares by the time.
No, Chris, talk about Thunderbird briefly.
It seemed to us kind of it's just another mail client. You know, I didn't see anything particularly that made me stand out and go, "Wow, this is actually quite good."
So if I took away your computer tomorrow and gave you a new computer and it had Thunderbird on it instead of Kmail, you just carry on?
Yeah, I really wouldn't care that much. I mean, it seemed I tried doing things like RSS reading with it, and that didn't seem to work particularly well. But that might just be a case of I didn't spend enough time configuring it.
So you're not particularly wedded to Kmail. It's just the one you happen to use.
It's the one I happen to use. Yeah, I mean, it has certain advantages, but Thunderbird, it seemed okay. I mean, it's copying the kind of the whole Outlook thing. You know, as the whole Outlook layout going on, but it does threaded.
Evolution is just the same.
Yeah, it
how
does
Thunderbird copy the Outlook?
It's just the layout, the way it kind of looks.
Three-pane email.
Lies.
That's not Outlook. That's just general email client.
Have you seen Outlook these days? It goes three vertical panes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's ridiculous. The worst. Thunderbird is your left-hand folder view. Account
view. It's a standard three.
You can switch that on in Thunderbird, can't you?
Yes.
You can change them around in Outlook as well.
A lot of people seem to use that thing.
I'd rather grate my face off with a fucking cheese grater than use that.
You can move, every mail client's got, you know, a dozen different views and you can pick them all. Outlook's got it, Thunderbird's got it, Evolution's got it, Kmail.
The big advantage it does have over Outlook is the fact you can do threaded. You can view your mail as threaded. Outlook doesn't do it. It's the only thing that doesn't.
It does, but like Outlook 2007.
Okay, I haven't
used it. Absolute ultra bang on
that. Certainly 2003, the previous one or something?
Yeah, I think 2003 or 2002 or something.
Like
that. I don't
know. Yeah, previous versions anyway. Don't do it.
Well, I played with Thunderbird. I was jet lagged and I couldn't sleep one night, so I at 4:30 in the morning, which is when I seem to explore technology most of the time. I started learning how to do Debian packaging while I was like jet lagged one night as well. But
explains the quality of your Debian packages then.
Yeah, basically.
And indeed the absence of your Debian packages.
Yeah. Sorry, I'll refer to your Debian packages instead. Oh, hang on a second. fail. I installed Thunderbird. I installed Thunderbird from Hardy, but I also installed a thing called Lightning, which is the calendar support. And
this,
I installed
this is the Thunderbird plugin, yeah. And Sunbird's the standalone calendar program.
Yes.
Well, I can't really get a handle.
I believe
on
the Lightning plugin implements calendaring on its own, doesn't it?
That's right, yeah.
Right. Oh,
so to make sure my testing was fair, I wanted to use the most current kind of upstream one. So I got the most current upstream Lightning, and I got something called the Gmail provider, which
provider for Gmail.
That's right. And
provider for Google Calendar.
So I managed to get the calendar in my Gmail calendar, my Google Calendar working inside Lightning. I got my email from work set up in Thunderbird, and I also got a certain other email account of a project which I've not announced yet. I got that set up as well, and
I know what it is. I know what it is.
And it's I don't know. It's all right. It feels clunky to me. I mean, Evolution. I mean, and part
That's
of this
funny
is,
that you say that, because I feel exactly the same about Evolution.
Yeah, it's like obviously this is
in the sense of kind of slow when you click buttons or just
it's actually a fairly it's a fairly nippy client. In fact, that it loads pretty quickly. It loads a lot quicker than actually doesn't load a lot quicker than Evolution.
Evolution's a lot better than it used to be.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't find Thunderbird actually that snappy to start.
But things like, you know, when you send an email, it always throws up this dialog box saying send an email. I don't need to see that, you know.
What?
Yeah.
Send an email.
Whenever I send, whenever I compose an email, I click the send button. Then yeah. Sends up this little progress dialog box, which says the progress of sending the email.
Oh, right, okay.
Right, which irritates me. It feels
you have some kind of feedback, so you know the process is not stalling.
Yeah, but it could be like in the status bar.
Yeah, exactly.
Wayne Kmel's little arrow thing.
Yeah, it doesn't need a progress bar. It lasts a second, you know, because it sends the email. And it makes it feel slower. Like, I could be doing something else while it's sending the email. Sure. Which
I'd never thought about that, you know.
You know, which is one element. The other thing is that it feels non-native. It really does feel like...
I don't feel
like when you run a Wine application on Linux?
Yeah.
It feels to me
that's rubbish.
It does.
That's rubbish. I've noticed, sorry.
Believe me, I've used Thunderbird for a week. I spent an entire week using it, and then I went back to Evolution. Everything just felt more native. It really did.
That Evolution might feel more native, but I've never felt like I was using a non-native application using Thunderbird on GNOME.
I mean, it feels more obviously a lot more native than a WAN application. But, for example, having little icons next to the menu items. Little things like that. And I tried to install there's an Ubuntu theme. There's a human theme,
right,
which you can install in Evolution, but there was a problem
in Thunderbird.
In Thunderbird.
I mean,
but that didn't work.
That's interesting. Now, one of the big complaints about Firefox, especially for Mac people, has always been that it didn't feel native. And the Firefox people have tried very hard to do that. The new Firefox theme for Firefox 3 is supposed to fit in better, and the Linux theme is using native Tango icons and stuff. And I think the Thunderbird people haven't quite got to that stage yet.
I mean, if they did that, that would really have helped the experience of it a lot further. Firefox 3 does feel a lot more native to me.
Than Firefox 2 does,
The other thing I found, I mean, it worked pretty much well. There was a few little odd things. So, for example, the way I work with my email is that I want to see all new emails at the top of my list of emails. They're bolded, but also emails that I really want, I need to tend to. Once I've read an email, I star it. Mm-hmm. And what you couldn't do in Thunderbird was essentially, like in Evolution, what I've got is I've got all my starred emails at the top, and then underneath them, it's got all the newest emails. Right. Like
So you sort by stars and then by red.
Yes, yeah, you can't do that in Thunderbird.
Didn't know.
Which pissed me off.
You might find you could do it if you're better build a custom search or something.
Yeah, I mean, you could probably. And I searched for an extension. I installed a bunch of extensions. Right. So there was one called Threadbubble, I think it's called, which is whenever you get a new email, it basically reorders the threads in the order of your email. Mm. But that didn't seem to work very well for me. I've never really tended to use threaded views because it scatters all over your list of messages. I want it to work exactly how Gmail does it.
Yeah.
And
Gmail has totally spoiled me for other mail clients.
And I actually looked because there's no doubt about it, Thunderbird is excellent in terms of extensions, but there wasn't anything which basically has that threading view, like conversation view. And I did quite a lot of research into that because it's something I read ages ago, probably about a year, maybe even a year and a half ago, that they were looking at building into Evolution.
Yeah.
And if they did that would be fantastic. Why the hell they don't do it, I don't know, because it's so much easier.
Oh, I completely agree with you.
And particularly when you, like, with my work email, I have so many long complicated discussions going on lots of different subjects, that threading really does help in that regard.
Cool. I mean, to be honest with you, I think, to summarise here, for me, going to Kmart, going to a different mail client, was like going to America. 90% of stuff is the same, and then every now and again you trip over something which is different, you think, oh, that's weird.
And everything's overweight.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, so it...
It's just a test of what you're used to. I
think they're all pretty much comparable in terms of features. It just pick the one that works the way you like.
The thing is, as well, as it's certain assumptions that you make. Like so, for example, in Evolution, when I write an email, I want all email to go in plain text. I don't like HTML email. Right, so I'll write an email. So let's, you know, I'll write bullet points. And in Evolution, you can drop, there's a little drop-down box in the compose view, and it'll say, like, bullet point. And it'll put a plain text bullet point in there, like an asterisk, and you can type it, and it'll properly indent it and everything. Now, you can actually do that in Thunderbird, but what you need to do is you need to have, like, the normal HTML compose view, but then click the option in the preferences that says convert this to plain text.
So you have to compose in HTML?
Yeah, I've composed in HTML, then it converts it before it sends it. Oh, I needed to know how to do that.
That's why it always pisses me off with the formatting tools, then, isn't it?
Yeah. If you actually just say in there, just send us plain text, then it takes all your formatting tools away from you.
Right. I don't know. I've always had them still there, and that's why it annoys me, because I said I want plain text, and they're still there. But I think there's probably two points. You've clearly got really specific requirements of your mail client, and I guess everybody else has, and I think people tend to build in the functionality of certainly email clients, the functionality of the email client into your working process, the way you work. And I think that's probably why you find Thunderbird a bit weird and I find Evolution just irritating. And I think if I were to give Evolution a shot, perhaps I'd like it more, which I do intend to do at some point, listeners. but certainly I think Thunderbird is literally just a mail client. And you said off air that you tried like you've referenced it on the show, that you tried Lightning for calendaring and was it Provider for Google Calendar?
Yeah, yeah.
As well, the extension.
I tried that, yeah.
And you found them absolutely awful.
Well, basically, I installed it. There's a couple of things I liked. I mean, first of all, the way it integrates is actually quite nice. I mean, it adds like the little row of buttons for email and calendars and all the rest, and something about to-do lists. Mm-hmm. It actually looks really nice. The problem is it just didn't work very well in the fact that I'd look at a particular day and it would take at least 10 or 15 seconds for my events to display. It's clearly polling the server each time. That was one element. I don't know why it can't just update your calendars like when you add a new event or just poll it every once a minute.
Does
or something.
Does Evolution's calendar tie into Google Calendar or
it
anything
does,
like that?
And I actually got it working. Now. I tested it.
Right. Is it faster?
That's ultra
is
recent.
Is it better?
It's available in Hardy. It's been fairly... it's a recent thing because there was a bug in Hardy that was preventing it in the Hardy beta or in the release cycle. It's a bit slow and it feels a bit clumsy at the moment in Evolution. So I think they need to spend some work on it. And also... I was talking to, I think Chris said, you know, how does this, I said how it integrates with the GNOME desktop. If you click on the clock and it drops down, it shows you your list, it shows you like bold days where there's things going on. Like it really slows that up.
Right. Okay.
Which was a problem. But one thing I really liked with Lightning in Thunderbird was the fact that it showed you all of the appointments that you've got for that day.
Yeah.
And that was in a nice little sidebar because I like that because it means I can get up in the morning and I can look what I've got to do. Because it's quite easy to forget that you've got something in the afternoon. Or something like that. So that was quite nice, but it just needed a bit more. It just felt clunky. And I think if the Thunderbird people can spend some time, and maybe this is a packaging thing, maybe this is making sure that it's better packaged for Ubuntu, but it just felt like I was treading water a little bit. Like everything was there.
Because I guess you're working around all the things that you're not used to, all the things that aren't there that you're used to having.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just kind of
like. Thunderbird, it is just a mail client. And it works. It's like Chris finds KML quite comfortable to use. I find Thunderbird really comfortable to use because it's just a mail client.
Well, the thing is,
it works quite simply.
To me, the analogy is it's like there's a lot of bands who make all the right moves. Like, so for example, a metal band, they've got good sound, good vocals.
Arguable.
You know, they're making all the right moves, the musical techniques, but it just doesn't seem to mix.
Sure.
You know, and that's the way I feel about
special
it.
Special X factor.
Yeah, there's a certain... je ne sais quoi. That is missing. That I found missing from Thunderbird.
Well, you're wrong.
Fuck you.
And your mum.
And your gran.
I was in a discussion earlier today with Mr. Ben, Lug Radio Community Hero Emeritus. which means we're not going to give you the award again, but you can sort of morally keep it, as far as I can tell. Anyway, we were talking about various things to do with free software and so on, and he came up with an idea and said, I'd love to see this idea, and I said, you should write that idea up, it's a really good one. And what it was, his idea was that when you plug in a device, a media device, like an audio player or something,
right,
if your device that you've just plugged in supports Ogg Vorbis, as well as MP3, it should say, by the way, this supports Ogg Vorbis. Would you like me to transcode all your music?
Hmm.
So the idea is it's kind of a restricted formats wizard, like the Ubuntu restricted drivers wizard. So you don't hassle people about using Ogg until you know that they'll be able to use it. But when you do know they're able to use it, you kind of subtly encourage them. Why not do this?
Subtly encourage them with a big pop-up that says, we transcode everything to Ogg.
Yeah, I mean, in exactly the same way that the restricted drivers thing.
I've never seen this restricted
driver. Right, the restricted driver, this is in Ubuntu, I don't know if it's in other distros, but I imagine they've got something similar.
Right.
When it starts up, it'll say, currently running the free drivers for your NVIDIA card.
Right.
You can, if you want to, install the proprietary ones, and it's sort of, you know, tick here to install the proprietary ones, and then it gives you this little kind of one paragraph chalk talk about why that's a bad idea, but the benefits you'll get from doing it, so on and so forth.
Have you seen the Easy Codec installer? Is that in Fedora, surely?
Easy Codec installer is a very similar kind of thing, Codec Buddy or whatever it's called now.
I believe it was. I was talking to...
It's been integrated into Fedora under a different name, I think.
I was at a thing called the Community One, and like the community managers from Fedora...
Imagine my surprise.
The community managers from Fedora...
Are you going to Community 2 next week?
and OpenSolaris and OpenSUSE were there, and Carsten Wade, the guy from Fedora, said that, if I recall rightly, he said that they did put it in there, Easy Codec installer, but then they took it out there.
And there's something about it being called Codec. But anyway, Mr. Ben's idea was this, that you want to encourage people to use, I think we'd all agree, that you want to encourage people to use free formats for media where possible.
I believe in proprietary formats.
But shut up. But equally, there's no point in giving someone, you know, someone plugs in an iPod, there's no point in going, should I transcode all your music to Ogg so it doesn't work with your device? But if you know they've got something that it works with, why not try and encourage them to do it? And I thought, that's quite a good idea.
I think this is a fucking brilliant idea. Fucking brilliant idea. And I read his post as well. And I mean, this is something.
I'll try and link to it in the show notes, but it's at JediMoose.org.
Something, I mean, back when we were talking about, in the Ubuntu world, when we were talking about the Easy Codec installer, something that Mark Shuttleworth was very keen on was the fact that we educate users about, you know, if there's a kind of. If there's going to be an option to install proprietary software, then you should at least educate users. And I agree with him. I think that. We typically refer to, you know, inside the web browser, that's where we educate people about free software. And I think the idea of doing it inside the distribution is a fantastic thing. I'm not saying this is the view of the Ubuntu project. This is the view of me.
Fair. The question is then, how do you do this? I mean, obviously, realizing you magically detecting what their device supports.
I mean, as I understand, I mean, certainly HAL at the moment, when you plug a device in, it will recognise that device, and it's got a big database of devices to say what this device
It'll recognise it as an individual. This is an iPod 3G,
yeah, I mean,
whatever.
The kernel or whatever will say, this is a USB mass storage device. And HAL can go, okay, what's the vendor ID? What's the product ID?
Right, okay.
And then go, aha, I know what you are. I happen to know you are an audio player. And therefore, it can appear in Banshee. Now, I don't know at the moment whether HAL knows that this device supports Ogg Vorbis or not. But presumably, if we're going to kick this idea off, it wouldn't be that hard to build that process up. You know, so tagging device, you know, you've already got these kind of device... files, these device information blocks inside the system, going through each one and saying it supports Ogg Vorbis, it doesn't. It supports Ogg Theora, it doesn't. It supports MP3 and MP4. And it's got to be a useful thing.
Built up, presumably, if it doesn't find that, it just kind of doesn't pop up.
It just goes, well, I'm going to assume...
It handles it nicely.
You don't support Ogg Vorbis at the moment.
So I suspect that there is actually no way of knowing what codecs a device supports without somebody saying, I've got this device.
Metadata.
You can't interrogate a device to ask it.
So my worry at that point is, how do you know that the data is reliable? Because it's presumably user submitted.
Absolutely.
And, the
risk for that for me is that you're going to maybe transcode somebody's audio and then they can't play it.
Do you do it the other way around then as well? So it says, all your stuff is in ARG format. Your player only supports MP3. Shall we transcode it back?
You could theoretically, you could theoretically litter a distribution with little so-called helpful messages, which all have a box that says, don't piss me off in the future, right? With things like, you know, so you could...
Yeah, I mean, you could theoretically, this would say, you'd have a box on it saying, don't ask me again for this device. So it doesn't hassle you every time you plug the thing in. Oh, by the way, move to ARG Warp.
I mean, there's like, I don't care, shut up. There's a bunch of places where you could do it. So, for example, when you open your media player, if you've got your music collection. I mean, so a good example is Banshee. When you have Banshee, you can import from an iPod or another media player, or you can import files from your disk. And if those files are MP3s, it might be an idea to throw up a little message and just say, you know, have you considered ARG? Or the one thing I think, there's loads of little wrinkles that you need to figure out, but things like, you wouldn't want to pick one particular free format over another. So you'd want to be able to encourage people to use FLAC as well as ARG, as an example.
Yeah.
To encourage people to use Dirac as well as Theora. I mean, it depends on the maturity of the codec that we're talking about. But
to some extent, it depends on the device you put it. There's no point in saying to someone, oh, you just plugged in device that supports ARG Warbis, would you like me to transcode all your media to FLAC, so it still doesn't work?
I personally really
But if you've got something that supports ARG Warbis and FLAC, then yeah.
I mean, we've got our Ubuntu Developer Summit, which I'm going to tomorrow, and I'm going to speak to some people there to see if... I mean, this is not something I can do myself, but I'd like to encourage people at the UDS to do this, because I think it's educating people inside the distribution, I think, is a reasonable responsibility of the distribution.
Playing devil's advocate for a moment, I'd be interested to know how far you take it. I mean, if someone downloads Picasa and runs it, should you have a little pop-up that says, by the way, you could use FSpot, which is free software, where Picasa isn't?
I don't think,
interesting how far... So, I mean, I'm all in favour of educating users about the importance of freedom in kind of places where it's reasonable to do so. You don't lecture people all the time, but I wonder how far you take it. When someone installs Skype from the Ubuntu partner repositories, would it be worthwhile saying, you're installing Skype, that's fine, you're presumably your friends are on Skype, have you thought about using Ikiga?
I think
one
of the advantages of Linux for me is the fact if you run Windows for 10 minutes, an unbearable siege of pain, all the fucking nags you get. And I think at that stage suddenly it's becoming nagware, when it's every application.
Yeah, this is the worries.
It's going to be like you could be using this instead, and you have to make it go. Real play is the worst in the world.
Yeah, because it'll just be one more window you got to close down.
I mean, I wonder whether you'd make this part of I called it the restricted formats wizard. Analogous to the restricted drivers wizard.
Right.
But the idea is, you say this is the restricted formats wizard, and all these little windows are just manifestations of it. So as well as don't ask me about ARG, about this device again, you say don't ask me about restricted formats again ever. Mm-hmm. Right? I don't care. I'm prepared to deal with it. So you say don't ask me about transcoding my media to ARG, and then it doesn't ask you about Skype either.
My other doubt,
I'm prepared to deal with proprietary software. Shut up about it.
The other doubt I have about this, I mean, I'll admit straight away, right, getting people to use ARG in open formats, it really actually does mean quite a lot to me. I think it's quite important. I was hassling Jason Kreidner and his mate Bill of Texas Instruments about it all night at Lug Radio Live, and since, emailing him to annoy him about it as well. I'm quite aware that I'm complaining a lot and don't have a lot of answers. But my other...
Which puts you in room 101, isn't it?
Yes, unfortunately. I'm well aware of this. And I really do think that perhaps I ought to go away and do something about this.
We've had a discussion while you're out in the park.
I'm out of Lug Radio
as well.
I'm out of Lug Radio.
Come back, Sparks. All is forgiven.
Well, it works for me. my other doubt about this is... And this is a bit of a wrench for me to admit, but I worry about making people transcode their media into a format that isn't popularly supported outside of our community. And maybe if you replace your media player for one that doesn't play ARG, and you didn't realise, because most people don't, I mean, yeah. A lot of your end users aren't going to think, oh, well, I must buy a media player that supports ARG. You just think it's media and you put it on and it plays. And I worry about people buying a new audio player and it not working anymore.
The two things then, should it kind of, in this case, only transcode the stuff you copy onto the device, or should go through your entire file system and find all MP3s
The idea here is it just makes sure they're on the device as ARG.
Yeah.
I mean, on the one hand, that solves Adam's problem, because it can actually transcode your media library. The flip side of that is that
then
it doesn't actually matter what format it is. So you're not actually teaching anybody anything.
Yeah,
you're saying, I'm going to do this thing that's completely invisible to you, that's to do with freedom. And they're going to go, whatever, dude.
Whatever.
To me, they haven't learned anything.
To me, the way we should do it is, and again, I mean,
this can apply to other distros, but I know it from the Ubuntu perspective. But we have a very strong view on preferred applications, you know. So being able to say, this is my preferred web browser, this is my preferred email client, things like that. And I think we should, in many ways, have a preferred codex format or something like that. Or possibly even a preferred attitude towards freedom. You know, so I could imagine...
You've got sort of a freedom slider.
So I could imagine...
I'm being quite serious here. I jack it all the way up to, I am a nutter about freedom, and then it doesn't show me proprietary stuff. Some people could jack it all the way down, and then it
actually uninstalls the system, chosen operating system.
I actually think it'd be quite good to have non-descriptive labels on it as well. So just zero to nine.
So you slide it all the way down to naught, and then it'll go, well... I'll install the NVIDIA driver for you because you don't actually care about this, and then you'll get better graphics type of thing.
You can't really quantify it into a scale. But I mean, what I'm saying is essentially what will be interesting is to say... What will be interesting is to say, why don't you, you know, your preferred audio format is, let's say, OGG. And then, you know, when you rip a CD, it rips it to...
Of doing it is the fact that most distros don't support MP3 out of the box, and that's the way of pushing freedom.
Obviously, but I'd say what you could do is you could say my preferred format is MP3, and then it'll install the relevant codecs.
And to some extent, you can do that. I mean, it's slightly more complicated than that, but you go into GStreamer and say, I want to have an MP3 profile, and then everything that talks to GStreamer knows about MP3s.
Yeah.
So I had to set it up for SoundJuicer, and then it worked for everything else as well.
Right,
to some extent, they're doing that, but they're presenting it as kind of, here is a GStreamer property, rather than here is a whole system-wide thing, even though they're the same thing. It's a difference.
It'd be quite interesting, though. So I can imagine things like, video encoding, it's difficult because your preferred video encoding format for doing serious video work is probably going to be DV. High quality video format, whereas your preferred kind of video encoding for just, you know, other little bits and pieces might be Theora, which is lower quality.
Or MP4 or something. You know, and the first time you go, I prefer OGG Theora because it plays everywhere, and then you try and upload it to YouTube and it doesn't work, you get annoyed.
Yeah.
But equally, you don't want to say to someone, make it MPEG-2, which YouTube does accept, and then get crappy quality, massive file size video.
I mean, in essence, to me, the user should never ever have to care about a file being transferred from one format to another. So if your iPod only supports MP3, and you've got your music collection in OGG, it should do it under the covers.
I wonder if it'd just be invisible. Yeah, I mean, do you even need that?
Because that's how Banshee does it.
I do like that, your idea of having just, like, pick your default system codec. OGG.
If it's invisible, though, surely that defeats the whole object. The idea is it pops up this thing and says, OGG is better because...
That's a good point.
It depends whether you're trying to maximise convenience or educate the users.
Do we educate the users of this is a good thing, or do we say this is a bad thing? Do we say...
Do you encourage people who are doing it wrong?
Yeah, because the problem with that is that as free software grows and as open culture grows, then we're going to have more and more options in terms of free options. Like when you were saying earlier on about, well, you know, do we say for Picasa, you know, you should be using F-Spot. Well, should we be using Digicam or Gathum?
Yeah, I mean, you'd be okay with F-Spot and Digicam probably, because if you're using the KDE desktop, then you recommend Digicam if you're using... F-Spot there. But I mean, what do you do about media players?
Exactly. Is it Rhythmbox or Banshee or whatever, or Quad Libre or whatever?
At which point you've got to make a decision at the level of the distribution.
I mean, I think application choice is probably a bit much, but for codecs, I mean, just a generic, this is a piece of non-free software, may be an option, but...
This isn't a non-free format.
Do you do with the image things? I mean, like, if you download...
There are no non-free image formats.
The Photoshop format is non-free, isn't it?
That's not an image format.
Yes, it is.
Isn't GIF patent encumbered, or is that expired?
No, not anymore.
That was a W patent.
If you insert an OGG player and it says, do you want to transcode all this to OGG? And you go, yes. And then, so all your files are now in OGG format. And then you get rid of that and you bring in an MP3 player and you plug it in. Should it then pop up and say, everything's in OGG? This only plays MP3. I can transcode it if you really want to, but it's a bad thing.
I'd say it should go both ways. In the same way that if you want to install the MP3 codec, then it says this is a non-free format.
The problem with this then is it suddenly becomes, even though it happens in the background, it suddenly becomes a bit of an obtrusive thing because you're losing audio quality with every transcoding.
Kind of part of my problem with it, this the idea in general is the fact that you are defining a policy for how somebody should use their machine.
I believe. I mean,
and
it's a policy of encouragement rather than enforcement.
Yeah,
I think where you inform people in as non-intrusive. I mean, the thing is, you wouldn't want to do it for everything. I think you'd want to pick the most important things. Like, I think Adam's point earlier on about Windows turning into Nagware is a really key one. Is that it's tempting to say, well, yeah, we could just add a little. Like, one of the most pointless freaking things I've ever seen when I was playing around with Thunderbird was an extension to switch on a splash screen.
Yeah, I saw that one.
I mean, that's ridiculous. It's kind of like an extension to slow your software down. You know?
I actually didn't think about installing that just so I could look at what the splash screen was like and then turn it off again.
I mean, a splash screen does make software feel more professional to a lot of people. A lot of end users, they look at a splash screen and think, ah, this feels like a proper piece of software. In the same way, they're the same kind of users that will feel that software's more proper if it comes in a box.
Because look, I've got a picture in a window. Fuck off.
But it does. I mean,
if you look at, again, I'm more experienced with Ubuntu than the others, but when you install it out of the box, if you use the add remove software thingy, it starts off as just supporting open source applications. If you change it to be all applications, it gives you the little, this will allow you to install proprietary applications. We understand why you might want to do that, but here's a couple of lines about why you might not want to.
Yeah,
I think that's perfectly reasonable.
And again, I mean, it's trying to encourage people about something at the point at which they want to do it, rather than just popping up a nag box.
In some respects, you're letting your politics affect my software.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, but, you know,
I'm not sure it's a bad thing, but this is what devil's advocate
of having. I mean, part of me, I agree
with you. That's exactly what we are doing. We are letting politics affect it. But then part of what,
yes,
I believe the distributions, therefore, is not just to give people software on their machines, but to encourage them about the ethics of what we're doing. You know, this is a free software community, for God's sake. If you don't like ethics, fuck off and do Lego Mindstorms or something.
No, that's not fair. That's your view. I think people should be using free software and have no idea of the ethics. But because there's free software there, they can use it. There's going to be, you know, Adam made a point in the last episode that a lot of people will use Ubuntu because they have no idea of the ethics, just because it's the software's there.
Adam, in useful point, shocker.
right? And I think to a reasonable degree, there are people like that.
Because it's technically better, should I be nagged about your politics?
I'd hate it if we got to a point where if you don't have a knowledge of the ethics, you've got to fuck off. That'd be ridiculous.
But we didn't say earlier, you don't have a knowledge of the ethics.
Why not encourage? I mean, you said you think a good place to educate people is in the distro.
Yeah, but my point here is that I don't believe the role of a distro, or part of the role of the distro, is to give people a lecture about ethics. It's not a lecture.
Part of the role of a distro is to educate people about why the choices.
The thing I take issue with is your statement of, if you don't know about ethics, fuck off.
No, I think if you don't know about ethics, it's the role of the distro, at least partially,
I think partially
to educate you in that.
The way I see it, where it intersects with the responsibility.
We're talking about exactly the same thing, but you don't like the way I phrased it. It's exactly the same point.
Well, the thing is, where I see it intersecting, essentially, is that to me, if you're using a distribution and, a distribution will essentially have an identification with the ethics to a certain level, and these levels vary. And so using Ubuntu as an example, it's a free software distribution. If you install, like, the Easy Codec install, whatever, I think that it's reasonable for us to advise the user. In the same way that if a user is going to install a dodgy piece of software that's likely to have viruses in it on Windows, and you've got something like McAfee installed, then it'll say, warning, blah, 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 blah. And I think that installing non-free software in a free software system is actually a reasonable risk to the ethic. So I think it's reasonable for us to say, in these isolated cases, you should be aware of
that. And that's exactly what I'm saying. I think it's part of the role of the
No, I agree with you on that. My disagreement was the fact that you basically said, unless you have a knowledge of the ethics, fuck off.
I certainly did not say anything even
resembling that. Before you throw handbags at each other. Basically,
that's beautifully interjected, by the way. I've been giggling for a couple of minutes because I've spotted these two going off on one. Please carry on.
Yeah, so are we saying that basically we like the idea of having this demon, whatever it would be, that does this, but it should have different levels that are settable? So some distros would say, yeah, I am Debian, therefore we will force everyone to use Arg and we won't let them transcode back, whereas other ones will say, like, yeah, Suzo,
settable at the distribution level, not by the user.
So the distribution can say, well, we support free software and therefore it will transcode to Arg but not back to MP3, and Suzo could come along and say, well, you know, we want to do it,
I think
it would
be nice to have it in a relatively distro independent way, but I don't know how independent that could be, because I think that a lot of this integration happens by the distro.
This will be a kind of just a default setting. You know, to the properties and change it yourself or turn the thing off.
I don't know. I mean, if you look at Easy Codec Installer, for example, as I understand it, the Ubuntu people wrote it.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of moved back to be handled by GStreamer upstream now, I think.
Well, it was written as a hook in GStreamer.
Yeah, but I think now the project, I might be wrong about this, but my understanding of it is that it's either being maintained or being worked on by upstream GStreamer people. So it's going to end up, and Fedora were trying to pick it up and everything. So, yeah, I mean, at some point, a distro might end up actually writing this thing. It might be Ubuntu or Fedora or OpenSUSE or whatever. But I'm sure it could be picked up. We're talking about interacting with things like HAL.
Yeah, I mean,
you might find there's a sort of a piece which talks to HAL and sends out a debus message, and then you've got a distro-specific thing which pops up the window.
I think a chunk of it can be, because, you know, most of the distros use essentially the same pieces of the platform.
Yeah, all I was thinking is kind of basically in the preferences panel, it has a certain settings, like, you know, your slider thing about between being, you know, 0 to 10, and different distros will default that to different numbers.
I think it will be
when in their default install.
It will be good to kind of for each distro to essentially have a.
It would be interesting to see.
It'd be interesting to see what those settings would be.
What they were,
Exactly. All distros use the same things. Like, so essentially, the way I could imagine it is you have a bunch of checkboxes.
Yeah.
Because I think the slider would be...
Imagine
you have a bunch of checkboxes, and then basically imagine it gives you a purity rating or something.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see what would happen.
And what distro's put in as their default setting. Someone just goes, we're going to be 65% pure. Another one goes, we're going to be 90% pure. We're going to be 30% pure.
I still really like the idea of having a slider with non-descriptive labels.
That's just because you're fucking belligerent.
Well, yeah.
So, it's the end of the show. Time for the Debian.
Thank you.
MPT, set your timer.
And what Chris is alluding to here is after the discussion we had in the last show about Gobuntu, we've received, and I've counted them so I know this to be the truth, 140 million emails giving me a beating about my feelings about Gobuntu. I'm going to run through just some of the names here. We had mails from Tim Retu, Martin Meredith, Trevor Valenda, Andrew Mason, Terry Love, James Stone, Chris Fletcher, Ben Bromley, Will Manley.
And every single one of them just said,
use Debian!
Not every single one of them. A large proportion of them said, you should use Debian. I mean, one of them, I've pulled various quotes out of all them because they all sent quite similar emails with things like, if you're concerned about both freedom and community, you should consider working with the Debian GNU/Linux project. And as far as I know, neither Fedora or Slackware ship with non-free software, and I'm sure most other people who care about freedom probably just don't install those components, and that's enough for them. A couple of people decided to take me to task about the fact that I haven't worked hard enough to make this possible. A couple of people suggested that maybe Gobuntu should release only with each long-term support release of Ubuntu. We've had people mentioning the fact that I was wrong about GNU Sense and it was based on Ubuntu Dapper, so it did have a 2.6 kernel and so on and so forth. Comments like, I think that the people advocating free software need to be targeting the hardware manufacturers, not necessarily the distros. We had lots and lots and lots of ideas about this. One slightly concerning chap, I was a bit worried about this, he said, the difference between you and I is that your voice is heard loud and strong, whereas mine is just another one in the crowd. Just by expressing your views on air, you are at least giving people an alternate viewpoint and people actually listen to you. In a kind of, if you give up, it'll discourage other people.
I think that's slightly worrying. I thought the point more was the fact that, you know, if you, as somebody who has a certain presence in the open source community,
very large presence.
Shut up.
He decides to do something and to fire up the Ubuntu project, you have a chance of actually making it work because, you know, people will at least listen to what you say, even if they then disregard it. Whereas if he decides to do it, people won't even listen to him.
I think it's a valid point.
I
think it's a valid point, the fact that if somebody who has got an audience, be it through a blog or a podcast or whatever, expresses a certain viewpoint and even expresses a viewpoint in which they feel discouraged, in which they feel like, oh, well, what's the point in bothering? Then other people who look to them for kind of, I'd say inspiration, to be honest with you, will kind of also possibly feel a little bit discouraged. The moral of this story is that no one should ever look to ACK for inspiration.
Thank you. I'm touched. I do have a particular comment about the Debian thing, though. An awful lot of people wrote in and said, you see, if you care about freedom, you should be using Debian. And there is a reason I don't use Debian. I am going to download it again and try it because I haven't tried Debian for a little while. But I was a Debian user for years before I used Ubuntu. And the distinction between the two is, I think, I believe, and I need to test this, but I believe I will find it a great deal easier to take Ubuntu and make it free enough for my liking. I'll find that a lot easier than I will to take Debian and make it usable enough for my liking.
Yeah.
The Debian project and I have different views on how much you should know about your computer, what decisions you should make. To pick my canonical example for this kind of thing is when you install Debian, it would ask you which X resolutions you wanted to configure. Right. Now, I don't fucking care about that question. I wanted to just pick the best one and set it
question.
Up. Well, yeah, but that kind of attitude pervades the thing. Now, I understand that there are lots of people who to whom that sort of question is important, and Debian are right to service that community. They've decided that's the approach they want to take. They, you know, they don't want to hide questions away from you and make decisions for you. They want you to take control of your computer. I understand that completely, but essentially the Ubuntu project can and is by me viewed as Mark Shuttleworth and his gang of merry people spending millions and millions of pounds and 5 years and 200 people to take Debian and make it usable enough for me.
Haven't
Stuart
all Langridge. those changes then been rolled back into the upstream and therefore back down into Debian?
I don't. This is why. This is why I want to try the latest Debian, because as I say, I haven't tried Debian now for probably a couple of years, and it may have changed. What I don't know, I mean, I'm assuming that when Ubuntu patch anything in Debian, they make the patches available because it's all open source.
Yeah.
But if Debian pulled all the patches, Debian would be Ubuntu.
The thing is that Ubuntu makes all the patches available, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be merged into Debian.
No.
Because there can be varying
goals
and perspectives.
Okay, so yeah.
I am going to try Debian again, but
you're not holding out a lot of hope.
I'm not holding out a lot of hope, because I genuinely think it will be an easier project for me to take my Ubuntu distribution, 99.5% of which I am happy with, and work out how to turn off the 0.5% I'm not, rather than take Debian and make it usable for me. That's what I think about that. Right, next subject.
Is it me? I've got an email here from Christian Holm, who's the guy that been mailing us about Emacs.
A very sensible and talented guy, obviously.
is he telling the world that Emacs is shit?
Is there a load of stuff at the bottom of his email where it says like Control X, Control C, and then colon WQ because he can't work out how to quit it to send the email?
Colon WQ. Oh, it made me laugh.
Listen to another a little audio snippet where you say, "Yeah, the thing is with Emacs, you have to open another shell just to kill it, so you can get out."
Kill -9 Emacs, which you have bound
to Control X, Control C.
So Christian Holm tells us, his subject is "Please help me." He says, "I have a friend which I haven't spoken to in a while, and when I finally did, he told me he was finishing some IT education this spring. Then I asked what he'd learn, and he answered Java and Windows.
Ooh.
Dear God, I thought, he's been brainwashed. When I tried to explain about Linux and all the possibilities for development in the Linux platform, I described it as open source. Is that what they use in Russia and China or Eastern Europe?" he asks suddenly. So I love the way he phrases this. "What the fuck could I tell this fucker to convince him that GNU Linux and free and open source software is a good thing? I could tell him to learn another language like Python to get some perspectives and to have a stronger position when he applies for a job, or I can scream at him about the four freedoms. I believe his attitude is, all I need is Java to get a good job. I believe his attitude, all I need is Java to get a good job, is a fucking narrow-minded and dangerous way to think. I'm not trying to piss on Java, but it is possible. But is it possible that Microsoft developers get indoctrinated to only think Windows and Java /VB/.NET? Cheers, the Emacs boy, aka Christian Holm."
I'd say on this particular point, first of all, I don't think it's completely unreasonable for people to think, I need to learn this technology, it will get me a job. That's the reason why people go and learn certain technologies.
I think the Sun people would be horrified to find Java developers described as being Microsoft developers.
Yeah.
I want to point out.
It's like, it's not unreasonable for someone to say, okay, there appears to be a lot of jobs in Java, therefore I will learn Java because I want to have a job.
And there are a lot of jobs
in
Java.
And the other thing is, just speaking personally, I think the way you convince someone like that over is to not issue them the four freedoms.
No, I agree. I mean, to be honest with you, the approach I'd take to explain to them is say, yeah, I mean, building Java applications on Windows is going to get you a job. There are lots of jobs out there. But there is no way it can hurt for you to have a wider skill set. If you can move in between different platforms, different jobs, it's going to help you get other jobs in the future. And he can take Python as an example and start playing with it with no impact. He can start on Windows, he can move to Linux if he wants to, and he's still got that flexibility. If you said to him, if you want, you should learn other technologies because it's good to help you get jobs in the future, it's a lot easier to take Python and start playing with it than it is to take Visual C++ and start playing with it, because Python doesn't cost you any money.
The thing I'd also say is Ubuntu or Fedora or whatever, Linux in general, is an excellent platform for Java. And to say, you know, you can run Eclipse and you can run Glassfish and you can run OpenJDK and all these different types of things. You can run that. You can learn all about Java, and you can make it a Java platform, and encourage him to come over to start using it as a platform to do Java development on. I think the way you bring someone to free software is not by making them use Python.
See, I'm tempted just to say stuff him. Basically, if he wants to do Windows and Java, let him. More jobs for the rest of us. You know.
But cool.
Is that now about it? Why should we bother to persuade him if he's happy?
I mean, you know? There are a certain segment of people out there in the world that really either just don't get it or just don't care.
Yeah,
fucking Linux is shit, and then they give you these ridiculous 1988 list. Oh, sorry, it's a bit early, isn't it? Shit, this kind of like 1994 list of reasons why Linux isn't as good as Microsoft or Windows. Yeah. But conversely, to Chris's point, and this doesn't necessarily relate to developing, but I believe it relates more to sysadmin jobs. I think Linux sysadmins are paid more than Windows.
Yeah, but I mean, for some people, IT is just a job. Yeah, and if they can get their pay for Java and Windows and go home at the end of the day and do whatever it is they want to do with their life, then fair enough.
Yeah, absolutely.
Some of us care about IT and do with it in our spare time at sort of quarter to one in the morning.
There's a number of different approaches there, Christian.
Could also argue that if he's going to write in Java, he could write in Java on any platform.
Exactly. Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. I'd say show him how he can be productive on Linux as a platform with what he knows, which is Java.
Yeah.
And invariably, Eclipse is going to be a great start on that. But the other thing is, I think I agree with you, but I think we should always educate people as to why they should consider Linux. And if they, at the end of the day, if they think, well, no, I'm quite happy with Windows, fine. As long as they've at least been educated.
I think we're talking about moving stepwise. Mm-hmm. If you want to encourage him to broaden his skill set, you can either encourage him to broaden the Java skill set or encourage him to broaden the Windows skill set.
The key thing, Emacs boy, right? You referenced Emacs.
Don't go and shoo the guy.
Yeah, he mentioned that email flagged some concerns in me at first. He mentions Emacs, he refers to it as GNU/Linux, and he referred to the four freedoms, right? First thing, don't bollock him for using Windows. Secondly, don't bollock him for not referring to it as GNU/Emacs, and thirdly, don't make him use fucking Emacs. All right,
that is a valid point. I was actually thought of something else.
Emacs on Windows is quite good, actually.
You could also point out to him that Linux is one of the fastest growing operating systems on the planet, and it's the commodity operating system of tomorrow. Yep. And therefore, he should bear in mind when he's writing his Java code on whatever platform he's writing on it, be aware that he should make it a bit more platform independent with regard to system paths and not hard coding shit like that.
At the end of the day, if he really doesn't care, I really wouldn't push it.
One last thing, which I think is an incredible thing to tell people, particularly people who are wanting to get jobs, is to say, if you come over and you get involved in open source, whether it's on Windows or Linux, whatever, you can get code published to the world. You can write something, commit a patch, and when you go to an employer, you can say, I've had, you know, this code that I've written being used by thousands of people around the world, which you can't do.
That's a very
particularly for kids particularly for young people who leave university or whatever. It's very difficult to get in because you don't have any experience, whereas open source and free software is a great way to get experience.
And there are plenty of employers now who are starting to realize. I've reading something by the 37 Signals people saying if you're looking to employ people, one great way is to see whether they've got open source experience and open source contributions, because you can see how they've interacted with the community. You can see what their code is like. You can see how they've dealt with it. So it's a great way to get experience of someone who hasn't worked. Whereas if you go to their previous company and say, what's their coding quality like, they're not going to answer your question.
So did they read, you know, some guy go for a job at 37 Signals, they've written libgradient, put gradient on the side of anything.
Harsh, but basically fair about the 37 David, Signals people.
Hanemeyer Hansen. We've had an email from Thomas Stewart, who refers to himself as being the synchronization king. Which he seems very proud of. So Thomas says, sometimes your knowledge and opinions are excellent and sometimes they are bad. But damn it, this takes This takes cake to the point of shouting at the screen, oh my god, use fucking Google, for fuck's sake. I'm not sure what he means by cake. I think
that's take the biscuit.
This isn't the guy that's Austrian and apologises for his English later in the email,
no,
is it?
No, that's another chap who wrote on the same subject.
I use www.scheduleworld.com as the hub for my synchronising my work outlook, my work evolution, both my laptops run evolution, and my mobile phone sync my calendar. That's work and personal contacts, email addresses and phone numbers, tasks and notes to sw.com, which is scheduleworld.com.
Yeah.
What if I happen to be away from work, lose both my laptops, and drop my phone in a pint? It means you're a fucking idiot, my friend.
These are worse problems than...
Yeah. So says Jono, one phone in every airport in the world, Baker.
Shut up. And actually, my phone has been submerged in a pint and stopped working as well. Well, they provide a web interface to access all
the stuck at your bum was a problem as well.
Thank you. Thanks again. It was your phone.
It was my bum.
For God's sake. Sorry.
Big, fat BlackBerry.
Suddenly the wheels come off the scene.
Welcome to Crackerjack.
Every bloody week.
Anyway, basically he's saying that this thing's really good. We should use it. You can contact him at thomas.stewart@synchronizedking@scheduleworld.com.
Is he actually at Schedule?
No.
No, I thought that was a bit hard.
I was going to say, that's a snappy one, isn't it?
He said he even wrote a small bit of cruddy Python that gets his calendar and prints the current events. This is cron to write the output to a file. This guy takes synchronization very seriously. I actually do believe he might actually be the synchronized king. Take a look at Schedule World and you too could become a king.
I'll be honest with you. Speaking as a bit of a synchronization nutter myself, I use Schedule World.
You are a synchronization nutter.
You are.
You've really got like a proper bone on over that synchronization thing that you were banging on about.
I know. I do. I mean, I do take it seriously. I want my calendar appointments to appear on my phone and I want them to appear on every laptop I've got.
You read up on synchronisation before you get in the shower with all the lads, don't you? After a rugby game, just so you've got half a lob on so you don't look tiny. No. Sorry.
He's got like
determined to bring this segment down.
He's got like a copy of Men Only, and then inside that is like Synchronisation Weekly or something.
Synchronisation Weekly.
So you can read in five different places at the same time.
But you wouldn't synchronise weekly because then you'd miss 5 days' worth of appointments.
You need to shut the fuck up in so many different ways.
Right.
Schedule
World.
So should I.
This guy rattling on about Schedule World. I use Schedule World for everything, but I don't use it because it's the best thing on the market. I use it because it's the only thing on the market, right? It sucks. But there's nothing else you can use. Now, one of the things I want to look at is Conduit, which is supposed to synchronise everything to everything else. And we've got a chap coming to talk about that at Lug Radio Live this year.
Yes. Yes. So, yes, indeed. Yes.
And you can talk at Lug Radio Live too. Ha ha.
Nice. Very smooth.
Note the smoothness of my segue. Right, 19th and 20th of July this year. Get your call for papers. We have a call for papers out. So if you want to speak at Lug Radio Live, mail us at show@lugradio.org. And if you want to exhibit at Lug Radio Live, mail us at show@lugradio.org. And if you want to go, keep an eye on lugradio.org/live.
Indeed.
Right, we need to give someone a t-shirt for sending the best email. I think it should be the Schedule World guy.
Yeah,
I personally, because it's such a bone on about
synchronisation.
He's talking about
so?
Keep your little synchronisation friends in our threads.
No, I liked Christian Holmes' email. I think that might be one of the only other ones we read out, but I think Christian's already won one.
Right.
And it would be mean to send him another one.
Right.
Are you sure? I'm not entirely sure we've sent him the first one yet, but you know.
Well,
what's this week? Shush. You haven't sent him the first one,
Postmaster
Christoph.
General.
Right. Okay, so
Thomas Stewart,
Should we send us your address.
Yep, and we will send you, Chris will send you a t-shirt.
We will send you an exclusive Lug Radio Don't Listen Alone t-shirt, only owned by people who have mailed the show.
And Thomas, do us a favour, right? Wear the t-shirt and hold a sign saying, I am the synchronisation king, and have a crown on as well.
And send it to
and
us.
And send a picture to us.
That'd be good.
Yes.
Oh, tell us what size t-shirt you want as well.
Yeah, size t-shirt and what address to send it to.
Right, so Thomas, let us know. Other people who have won t-shirts, take pictures of yourselves in improbable places and send them to us.
Such as, you know, workplaces.
Absolutely, wear your Lug Radio t-shirt at work. Brilliant idea. People who haven't got a Lug Radio t-shirt yet, the way you get one is you write in and send us the best email. You know it makes sense.
Yes, you do. It's been a long show, hasn't it?
It has been a very long show.
Shall we,
have we finished?
Think about maybe wrapping up? It's quite late.
Okay.
Don't forget, pack.
I think we should do the Lug Radio Live bit now then. before you finish the show then.
And we just done it.
Haven't I already done that?
Was I not listening?
Yeah, while you were checking
lug
radio.
No, do you know why? Do you know why? What I was doing? I was actually looking for the Lug Radio Live 2008 USA video thread on the forum so I could tell people where it
another
is.
Another smooth move. If only you two were as smooth as the ladies.
If only I'd been listening to when you were doing the Lug Radio Live bit, perhaps.
Less smooth.
It's about as smooth as the Himalayas now.
Right, if you couldn't make it to Lug Radio Live in the USA, which
shame on you.
No, right, Nessie, now you be quiet now, right? Because you're going to get this wrong.
Okay.
If you couldn't make it to Lug Radio Live in the USA, go to lugradio.org/live and click on the link which says videos from Lug Radio Live USA.
Ah.
Right? Yeah. Adam was about to say there's also a thread in the Lug Radio forums about it, which you should go and read, yes. And if you like some of the videos, comment on them, because that's where Tony Whitmore, who's doing all the work, is actually posting about
yes,
them.
It's all Tony.
But I'm making sure that information ends up on the real Lug Radio Live USA site.
Are all of these videos up yet, or are we still in the process?
There are 33 by the look of
we
it.
We are.
So most of them should be up.
We're there. Missing three or four. Which we're currently sorting out.
Last time I looked, which was about a week ago, there were only three, and between then and now, he's made 33 posts, and some of them contain more than one video. So all the talks, apart from one or two or three or four.
Thank you to Tony Whitmore.
Thank you
for doing
much,
all
Tony.
Of this. Yes. He's a good guy. All right, so let's have a quick run through the places where people can find out more about Lug Radio. So the forums are
forums.lugradio.org.
The IRC server is
irc.freenode.net.
And on that ISC server, you go to which channel?
#lugradio.
And where can you see a picture of the Chinny Raccoon?
Chin.lugradio.org.
Where can you go and game with other enemy territory people?
Clan.lugradio.org.
Don't look at me, Chin.
Where can you find the Lug Radio fax database?
Is that quotes.lugradio.org?
No.
Is that facts.lugradio.org?
No.
Something else, .lugradio.org.
Planet.lugradio.org/fax, I think.
Oh.
Where can you find the planet?
Planet.lugradio.org.
Where can you find my website?
Cryogenics.org.
Where can you find Axe's website?
Cryogenics.org.
Pink.com.
That's probably real, actually. We should, since we're talking about planet.lugradio.org, you can go to planet.lugradio.org/#lugradio, H-A-S-H, Lugradio, which is the other guys who do a show. They haven't done one for a little while, but I believe they're going to be putting one out soon, so that'd be cool.
Yeah, it's a podcast about the podcast. They basically talk about what we've talked about in the show.
And then slag us off.
And the other thing I wanted to mention is last time we did the 100 Greatest Things, we mentioned a couple of, I don't want to say rival podcasts, because we're all in this together. but we didn't mention to others the Linux Link Tech Show and Linux Outlaws. So, once you've listened to all the Lug Radios in your collection, and then you've listened to them all again, and you've listened to all the Lug Radio Live videos, and you think, now I am bored. Linux Outlaws and the Linux Link Tech Show and the Linux Action Show and past issues of Linux Reality. Are there any others?
I believe Linux Outlaws are coming to Lug Radio Live to exhibit.
Really?
I believe so.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
That'd be cool.
German McSchnitzel, or whatever his name is.
His name is not German McSchnitzel.
What's that? Well, he's going to come now, isn't he?
Well, that's one more.
Wouldn't it be Austrian McSchnitzel, anyway?
Oh, by the way, I'd just like to put out a very small shout out to... There's a guy who's created this video podcast called Progbox.
Oh, Pete Savage.
Pete Savage. And... Pete's done an excellent job, and he's done it all on Linux. I think he's using Sinalera for it, because...
He is. He was using KDE Live, and then it turned out to be bollocks. Yeah. And so he's using Sinalera.
And he's doing it all himself, and he's actually done a really good job on it, and he deserves a bit of a shout-out. And it's spelt ridiculously. It's like prog fucking...
B0XYX or something.
But do a search for Pete Savage, and he's also... If you go to planet.ubuntu.com... you can see his blogs on there, and you can find it in his blog entries. But he's done an excellent job, so do go and check out his video podcast. So that's it.
Love it.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.
Hi.
Oh, hi.
Oh, hi.
Oh,
hi.
Oh, bye.
Oh, bye.